40 Iraqis are reported dead in Fallujah today following the American bombing of a mosque there. Witnesses tell the Associated Press the strike came as worshippers gathered for afternoon prayers. But there are other reports of 5 Marines shot by insurgent fire from the mosque. The fighting in Fallujah and in neighboring Ramadi, the town in which 12 Marines were killed yesterday, is part of an intensifying uprising of both Sunni and Shiite Iraqis, stretching from Kirkuk in the north to Basra in the south. Also, there's growing tension within the U.S.-led coalition. Japan's urged the United Nations to intervene. Bulgaria's called for U.S. troops to reinforce its 450-man battalion. Pamela Hess covers the Pentagon for United Press International. She joins us to discuss the latest on the situation in Iraq. Pamela, welcome.
Thank you.
Pamela, what are you hearing about how widespread the fighting in Iraq is today?
I think if you look at the reports, it seems very widespread, but I'm not sure that there are a great numbers of folks. I would say what we're understanding from the Pentagon is that in Ramadi, the attack was carried out by about 60 or 70 people, and similar numbers in other cities. So taken all together, probably around 1,000 or maybe a few more of people actually fighting, or actually it could be even less than that, but armed with rocket-propelled grenades, secreted inside of buildings, they can do an awful lot of damage and lead to some extensive firefights. And I think that's what you're seeing. I'm a little troubled by characterizations that this is a nationwide uprising. I don't think that's the case. There's 25 million people in that country, 15 million Shiites, and the folks that are fighting, I don't think necessarily represent the general populace. There's a lot of competing agendas and different groups there that are armed that are trying to take advantage of this time.
Yeah, very few fighters can be very lethal. What's the latest you hear about the key Sunni city of Fallujah?
Fallujah is there's fighting that's still going on. General Mattis, who is the commander of the 1st Marine Division, which is in Fallujah, has told reporters that are embedded with him that they're seeing some Syrian foreign fighters there. It seems to me that what reading between the lines of what the Marines are saying officially, I think they're concerned that the Army presence that was there before was too far outside of town, and it allowed those insurgents combined with whatever foreign fighters might be there, and now maybe whatever Mahdi Army or the Shiite Army militia that is loyal to the cleric Young Muqtada al-Sadr, allowing them to get a stronghold, get organized, relatively free of any interference. The U.S. posture in a lot of these places was they wanted to avoid fighting. They wanted to avoid being targets, and they wanted to avoid causing any trouble. And so what they wanted to do was sort of stay on the outside. In the last couple of months, they pulled from the centers of cities to the outside to allow Iraqi police and civil defense forces to do security. And I think that what the Marines are finding now is that in a place like Fallujah, that would have been a good idea had Fallujah been sort of calm and contained from the start and had there been a good Iraqi security presence. But it doesn't seem like that's what's happening. So what the Marines are faced with right now is going in and really sort of doing the urban fighting that was avoided there during the war and sort of trying to get rid of their adversary there and then see what they can do about reestablishing peace. But it seems like Fallujah is a pretty big battle right now.
Pamela Hess covers the Pentagon for United Press International. Pamela, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Well, many Americans picked up their newspapers today to see some unsettling photographs from the Iraq War. In one picture, a Marine is loading the body of a comrade killed in yesterday's Ramadi firefight into a Humvee. In another, he's carrying the body bag over his shoulder across a dirt road. That picture was taken by David Swanson of the Philadelphia Inquirer, embedded with the Marines. We reached him at a Marine outpost outside Ramadi. And David, first of all, what happened in yesterday's firefight?
My company responded to a firefight at the entrance of Ramadi. We all jumped in 7-ton trucks and Humvees and chased to that scene. Fighting had stopped for a little bit. The Marines were going house to house looking for shell casings to see if people were firing from the rooftops. At that point, we came under heavy fighting and advanced towards the shooting, probably running in and out of 10 to 15 houses, going up on the roofs and trying to locate who was firing at us. And They were using machine guns, Kalashnikovs, and some booby traps with hand grenades.
I'm looking at yesterday's photo after the firefight. It's a Marine. He's casting a long shadow. There's a dead Iraqi in the background on the ground. And over the Marine's shoulder, he has a body bag.
I know the photo. That's when pretty much the firefight ended and everyone was securing the area. That one Marine came around the side of a building. I didn't realize there were still Marines dead in the area. And he just, you know, picked the body up by himself and walked to the back of the Humvee and placed it in the back there.
Yeah. David, here in the U.S., we haven't seen a lot of body bags. What were you thinking when you took this photograph?
Well, the fact that it was in a body bag, I had to assume it was a Marine. He just carried the body bag with dignity and was very careful to lay the body bag in the back of the Humvee, which had four tires blown out, and it would be later towed back to base with the other Marines riding with them with the body bag in the back.
Hmm. Again, we haven't seen a lot of pictures of body bags. Did anyone try to stop you from taking the picture, or was there...
I did have a run-in earlier in the week that they didn't want any photographs of wounded Marines, and I said, otherwise it's all in vain.
What did they say to that?
There was no answer to that.
Do you feel you might have known this Marine?
I knew 6 of the 10 killed from Echo Company. I don't know who was in that body bag. One of the Marines I spent walking 10 miles with yesterday, and we talked about fishing in Colorado when he got back, and I feel a great loss that he passed.
Oh, he was killed?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you ever question whether or not you should take the picture?
Not at all. That was war.
But again, I'll just mention it one more time. We just haven't seen a lot of body bag pictures here in the U.S. In the past, have you seen body bags and not taken the picture, or have you not seen many body bags?
I've seen them come in to bases in America. I've never seen them out in the field, military-wise.
David, your photograph is on the front page of many American newspapers, and it's shocking a lot of people. It's a very powerful photograph, and people are responding to it. Your thoughts on that?
I need to think about that because that justifies why I'm over here. I just hope people understand that a lot of people are getting killed over here, Iraqi and Americans.
David Swanson, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Swanson of the Philadelphia Inquirer. To see his photographs, go to our website. Well, U.S.-led coalition forces in Iraq may have inadvertently achieved at least one goal, uniting at last some former fierce rivals in a jihad, holy war, against Americans. Joining us now on the line is Professor Fawaz Jurjis of Sarah Lawrence College. Rather, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Anthony Shadid from The Washington Post told us yesterday, and there are reports today of growing sympathy between Sunni Muslim insurgents and the Shiite followers of the anti-American cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. What do you make of this apparent growing alliance?
These reports represent a dangerous turning point, indeed. I think the United States now finds itself locked into a deadly and costly confrontation on two fronts, I think, which leaves U.S. troops exposed with no refuge at all. Mm. I think with the exception of the Kurdish region in the north, Iraqi cities and towns will likely turn into a death trap for the coalition forces in most Sunni Shiite towns and cities in Baghdad, in Fallujah, in Ramadi, in Nasiriyah, in Basra, in Kufa, in Najaf, in Amara. We have reports of fightings in almost every single Iraqi city in the last 3 days. And I think in addition to the increased security risks as a result of the spread of resistance from the Sunni-dominated areas into the Shiite areas, I think this particular new development complicates further the process of political transition and transferring power to Iraqis at the end of June.
We're reading that in this mainly Sunni Ramadi, portraits of al-Sadr, the cleric, were posted on government buildings. There's graffiti praising him for his heroic deeds, his valiant uprising against the occupier. How unusual is that, that in a Sunni stronghold, there would be praise of a Shiite leader?
It's not historically shocking at all. In the 1920s, uprising against the British both the Sunni and Shiite communities joined forces in attacking British troops. And I think what we need to remember, just a footnote for our listeners, most of the tribes in Iraq have Shiite and Sunni members. That is, tribal intermarriage between Sunnis and Shiites is quite common. And I think this particular fact plays an important role in reducing the possibility of Sunni-Shiite communal strife, and I think also provides the foundation for collaboration against imagined foreign threats, like, for example, the American and coalition forces in Iraq today.
So as you said, there's precedence for this. Is this something the U.S. military should have known more about?
Well, I think the U.S. administration in Iraq has made some major blunders. I think by escalating the confrontation against Muqtada al-Sadr and his followers, the administration has set in Iraq has set in place a major process of social upheaval. Why shut down al-Sadr's weekly newspaper, Al-Hawza, regardless of how unpleasant it was? Why arrest one of his senior cleric aides, Yaqubi? Why opening a major front against al-Sadr and accusing the man of being not only an outlaw, but even a criminal? And I think all these moves serve to make a hero out of al-Sadr. Let's remember here that is al-Sadr, regardless of what you think of his opinion, that is, he comes from a very prominent religious authority. After all, he inherited a major, major prominent religious legacy. He is the son of one of the most revered ayatollahs, who in 1999 was killed along with his two sons by the former Ba'athist regimes. He has a major social base, in particular in al-Sadr city, a neighborhood of Baghdad, which has almost 2 million Shiites. He also, his radical and militant temperament resonates within a particular critical constituency in the Shiite community. Al-Sadr is one of the most popular leaders within the Sunni community, not just the Shiite community. If his uprising evolves and escalates, he could really, I think, represent a major, major security and political threat to the American project in Iraq.
But can U.S. forces afford to just let this cleric be?
No, I think at the end of the day, there is no military solution. I think there are political solutions.
Professor Georges, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure.
Fawaz Georges is a professor at Sarah Lawrence College.
Just ahead, we speak to former nun and religion scholar Karen Armstrong about her new book, The Spiral Staircase.
And later, are more American soldiers headed for Iraq?
There's more coming up here and now. Karen Armstrong fell in love as a teenager with the idea of serving God. She became a nun, but several years later she left the convent, psychologically traumatized, her faith in God shattered. Then for years she struggled to find her place in the world, a journey that eventually led to her groundbreaking book, A History of God, which is an exploration into the unity she discovered at the root of the three great monotheistic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. In her latest book, Karen Armstrong tells the story of her life. It's both a spiritual and very worldly odyssey called The Spiral Staircase. I spoke to Karen Armstrong recently in a chapel at Harvard University where she was about to give a lecture.
I entered the convent with such excitement, expecting that I would be transfigured and become saintly, Buddha-like. And I was really excited about it. But I didn't find God. And instead of being transfigured, I left 7 years later, obscurely broken and damaged.
Before we get to the part of your life when you became the writer that you are now, what were those years like after you left the convent?
They were probably the worst years of my life. Leaving a convent isn't like leaving a teacher's training college or an accountancy school. You're not learning a skill that leaves your private self untouched. This is a conditioning that is meant to last a lifetime, almost an initiation that is supposed to change you. And we were being trained to reject the world at quite a profound level. And almost I needed the kind of debriefing that people have when they've been in a cult or something of that sort. So when I came out, I did not know how to live. I became anorexic and suicidal, not because I wanted to die per se, but because I simply didn't know how to function out in the world. And the world had changed and become completely unrecognizable, because while I'd been inside, as it were, the 1960s had happened.
One breakthrough for you was discovering the root of your condition beyond the isolation, the change from the convent, the trauma of that. There was also a medical condition.
Yes. I didn't realize it, but I had temporal lobe epilepsy. I have since learned that people who have temporal lobe epilepsy tend, firstly, to be interested in religious and philosophical matters, almost compelled by them, and secondly, to write a great deal. If you think of Dostoevsky, who had this condition and writes about it very strikingly in his wonderful novel, The Idiot, think of all those great fat novels of his and Van Gogh's letters to his brother. Probably because this condition of epilepsy, because it's rooted in the part of the brain that controls emotion and memory, produces strongly psychic effects.
You did start to get on a more even keel through medication, and you went to Jerusalem. And that was when you began to read about the historical roots of the Christianity you'd been raised in, and that ultimately led to your famous book, The History of God.
In Jerusalem, I became aware of how parochial my religious vision had been. Up until then, I knew nothing about Judaism. I saw it only as a kind of prelude to Christianity. And I'd never really thought about Islam at all. But, you know, in Jerusalem, where you see these faiths jostling uneasily at the same sites, you become very conscious of the connections between them. And I started to read. I didn't see any one of them as the one true faith. And I was beginning to see, too, to look beyond monotheism, to beginning to see the Buddhism, Hinduism, also had profound similarities with what we in the West know about religion.
You refer to God as a kind of absence.
Yes, my life has been a constant search for a God who remains tantalizingly absent. And yet, very often when somebody we love is absent, we are often more preoccupied, is often more powerfully present in our mind than when he or she is physically present. There's a wonderful Kabbalistic saying that whereby one of the Jewish sages says that after the temple of Jerusalem was destroyed, a catastrophe for the Jewish people, the Holy One, God, ascended to heaven and dwelt with us no more. In that act of devastation, we experienced divine absence. And I have a feeling that perhaps after the collapse of the World Trade Center, that act of God, we feel the absence of holiness in the world.
So what about the millions who feel a presence, the presence of God? Is it just something in the head that in the history of God, you take us through it, emerges from a certain cultural context?
Look, this is fine. If people feel the presence of God, who am I to tell them that they don't? I'm not in the position of undermining anybody's experience or theology. But there is one acid test of any religious experience and any religious idea. That is that it must lead to practical compassion. That is the litmus test of spirituality in every single one of the major world religions. Now, if your sense of God's presence makes you compassionate and tirelessly active and concerned for the suffering of other people, and that you see, if you're a Christian, the suffering of Christ in all suffering human beings, whether they're on our side of the conflict or the other side, then that is a good religiosity. But if your sense of God's presence makes you belligerent, intolerant, cruel, or God forbid, kill other people in God's name, then this is not good theology, no matter how strong your conviction. This is not me pontificating on this. This is the wisdom that we find in all the major world faiths.
Karen Armstrong, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Combat igniting on fresh fronts all over Iraq, should more U.S. troops be sent there? It's a decision Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's always resisted. Yesterday, though, he said if U.S. commanders on the ground ask for more soldiers, they'll get them. Another possible scenario is delaying the return home of troops already in Iraq. Sig Christensen is the military reporter for the San Antonio Express News in Texas. Hi, Sig.
Hi there. Thank you.
Sig, right now a massive troop rotation is underway in Iraq, as you know, the largest since World War II, I believe. How could the fighting affect that troop rotation?
Well, Bill, one thing that can certainly happen here is that they will not send troops back to the States as quickly as they had planned. They have troops that they are rotating out of the theater on a daily basis, and that could stop, and that would give them some soldiers that they could put into hot spots immediately. That's a very quick short-term solution.
Sig, you talk to military people all the time. What's the consensus in the U.S. military now, do you think, about whether there should be more U.S. soldiers in Iraq?
Oh, I think the consensus was always there that they probably needed more soldiers. It depends on who you talk with, of course, but there simply aren't enough patrols out there. There aren't enough helicopter sorties.
Sig, do soldiers on the ground in Iraq have enough backup?
The Ramadi fighting apparently is some of the worst that we've seen since the Thunder Run, at least, into Baghdad. So that gives you a sense of what's going on. The other day that there were some people from a private security company who basically protected a wounded American soldier and held off Iraqi insurgents for several hours until the Americans could send a response team in there. So that right there tells you that there's a problem. You should see American soldiers coming in very quickly when somebody gets into trouble. And for whatever reason, that just did not happen.
Right. Sig, are there more U.S. troops outside of the 134,000 now being rotated? Are there more U.S. troops to send?
There isn't much there. 3rd Infantry Division is up next to the plate, and I suspect that they will probably move up the deployment date for 3rd ID. They could get more National Guard and reserve troops into the game, but those troops would require training, and that would take time. So your options get very, very few after you send the 3rd over.
Sig, how do you think we're doing in Iraq?
You know, sometimes the administration has been rather bold in the way that it's approached force distribution and strategy in Afghanistan and Iraq. In Afghanistan, it worked. They had a small number of troops, relatively speaking, and they used massive air support to rather quickly subdue the Taliban. But then sometimes you have almost the sense that these guys believe in Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy, and the Easter Bunny. And if they just wish hard enough, things will happen. Well, they wished that they could put a force in there that was relatively small and quickly win a war in Iraq. And they won on that gamble because the Iraqis were just really an incompetent group of soldiers. And in my opinion, I don't think many of them really wanted to fight that bad. But what you've got now is you've got insurgents who have something to fight for. They've had a year to gather themselves and prepare for a fight. And what you're seeing is the result of that. We don't have enough troops in that country. It is very painfully obvious. And more people are finally just admitting it, that Rumsfeld would say yesterday that he would consider it if his commanders said, yes, we need more. Is, I guess, something of a breakthrough. It may be the closest thing you will ever get to Rumsfeld admitting that he was wrong. But the worst part of this is that we're losing troops that perhaps we didn't have to lose. And if we're not careful, and if we lose the Shia, we will lose the country. And that's the worst part of it.
Sig Christensen is the military reporter for the San Antonio Express News. Sig, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, now for a look at Iraqi media coverage of the current explosive situation in Iraq. We turn to Eric Watkins, editor of the Iraqi Press Monitor, which translates Arabic language newspapers from Iraq. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks very much.
Eric, thank you. From our vantage point over here, the fighting in Iraq this week looks like an immense development. Now, is that how the Iraqi press is playing it?
Yes, they are. It is a big development, and a lot of the reports that we've had today are completely on this development. We had one today, in fact, that took us right inside one of the offices of the Muqtada Sadr. The office was bristling. That's the word he used, bristling, with clergymen and with the militiamen as they were, you know, getting ready, expecting that U.S. forces might attack them. And you can get this sense of the electricity of that situation from this particular report.
Does the coalition come across increasingly in any way in recent days as the enemy?
I think that throughout the Middle East, the United States is often looked at as the enemy. And in Iraq, even though the United States and its allies have liberated the country, it's still fashionable to refer to the United States and the coalition in particular as the occupation force, as though that force has come to sit on ordinary Iraqis and prevent them from doing something. And that's partly why there's not a great deal of sympathy when a U.S. Marine is pictured carrying a body bag of a comrade. It's viewed as an enemy having been taken out.
Have you seen any editorial shift more toward support for Muqtada al-Sadr in newspapers as a result of the coalition campaign against him now?
No, we haven't seen that at all. In fact, what you'll see in the papers very much is editors and opinion writers saying, you know, we agree that Muqtada Sadr has justified positions in the case of his newspaper being closed down. This is not a good thing and it shouldn't happen. But one of the papers made a very memorable comment, which was that, you know, you don't have to go to the barricades for these things immediately. There is such a thing as dialogue. Dialogue comes before rifles. So, yes, people are saying, yes, you know, this man is fighting against the coalition and that's good, but there are better ways to fight than through violent means. And this is very much a theme that's coming across all the papers that I'm seeing.
Just to finish up, a paper called Al-Mashriq, we understand, is reporting that followers of Muqtada al-Sadr have kidnapped two South Korean aid workers. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, the report is that they've taken them hostage. And the idea is that they're going to hold them hostage until the Italian forces in that particular town withdraw. This is one of the reports, and it will probably appear in the wire services later on.
Eric, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Eric Watkins is the editor of the Iraqi Press Monitor. He's based in Cyprus. His translators are in Baghdad. For links to the Iraqi Press Monitor, visit our website, here-now.org.
Still to come, a talk with writer and filmmaker Neil LaBute.
You're listening to Here and Now. ...75% of the world's heroin comes from Afghanistan. This week, hundreds of Afghan farmers marched to protest a government crackdown on growing the poppies used to make opium and heroin. But in the western province of Herat, there's an entirely new approach to discourage farmers from growing poppies. The idea is to replace that crop with crocuses, which can be used to make the world's most expensive spice, saffron. I spoke earlier to Hamida Ghaffour, who's been covering the story in Afghanistan for the Los Angeles Times, and I asked her, why saffron?
The incentive is basically that saffron is the nearest thing that can match poppy in price. You see, when a farmer here grows wheat, he earns about less than a dollar for a kilogram. For saffron, for a kilogram of saffron, he can make about $100. While for poppy, you see, he can make about $300. So the gains are actually pretty good if you grow saffron.
Yeah, but you can still make three times as much growing poppies?
Yes, you can, and that's where the law comes in. The provincial governor has been quite stern with farmers and has told them that if they do grow poppy and if they're caught, they will be arrested and thrown in jail. And a lot of the farmers don't want to risk the wrath of the warlords who controls Herat.
Yeah, that's Ismail Khan. He's not a man to cross.
Yes, that's right. Ismail Khan is arguably he's the most powerful warlord in the country.
Now, many warlords in Afghanistan have made their money from growing poppies. Has Ismail Khan ever made money from poppies? And if so, why is he against it now?
Ismail Khan has been accused by a lot of international observers of growing poppy, but it's not clear how much he grows of it. He probably makes his money from trafficking the drug into Iran.
But what is his rationale for forbidding it then?
Well, Ismail Khan wants to look good in front of the international community and look good in front of the central government. Now, to be fair to him and to be fair to Herat, the province is one of the few provinces where not much opium is grown.
Well, how have farmers responded to the call to grow saffron instead of poppies?
It's been sort of a mixed reaction. There's about 400 farmers in Herat who are growing it, and they're fairly optimistic. But the problem is that there's no market in Afghanistan for saffron. It's an expensive product. So you can, you know, hundreds of farmers in the country can grow saffron, but the question is, how do you transport it in a country where there are no roads? Where do you find dealers who will act as middlemen between the grower and the buyer overseas? Who's going to just determine the price for saffron? Is there going to be a government board set up to help them do that? These questions have not been answered, and it's a huge problem. It's not just for saffron. It's generally trying to set up some sort of market economy in Afghanistan.
Yet a market economy seems to thrive for poppies and heroin.
Indeed it does. The difference with poppy and heroin is that it's a very organized network controlled by the international drug mafia, mainly out of Uzbekistan, out of Russia, out of Pakistan.
Well, given all that we've discussed, what do you think the future then is of saffron, and does it have any chance of displacing heroin?
I don't think saffron can ever replace heroin. There just would not be the market for every farmer in this country to grow saffron. The point is that it's an alternative crop, and it's a legitimate crop. What the international community needs to do is come up with alternative crops like saffron to encourage farmers to grow something else.
Reporter Hamida Ghaffour writes for the Los Angeles Times. She joined us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Hamida, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Bill.
For an extended version of this conversation, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Neil LaBute has a nasty but solid reputation. He established himself as a screenwriter and director in the late 90s with In the Company of Men and Your Friends and Neighbors, two films full of caustic dialogue and despicable characters. Since then, he's been busy in Hollywood, adapting scripts and directing tamer fare, such as Nurse Betty and Possession. But before Neil LaBute became a successful filmmaker, he made plays, and he still does. His often controversial pieces have premiered in New York and London, where he's been compared to David Mamet, Sam Shepard, and Edward Albee. Right now, LaBute's post-September 11th play, The Mercy Seat, is having a run at the Lyric Stage in Boston. The author flew in on opening weekend, and Here and Now producer Andrea Shea joined him at the theater.
Well, well, Goliath awakes.
I'm just saying.
I heard you.
I'm just saying it, that's all.
And it's been noted. Duly noted.
That's Ben and Abby. He's married, she isn't, and their future as a couple drives the action in The Mercy Seat. Through them, Neil LaBute poses a provocative question. What if two co-workers who've been having an illicit affair decide to use the destruction of the World Trade Center as a means to obliterate their pasts and start over? Ben pretends he was killed. They hide out in Abby's apartment, rationalizing their decision and taking bites out of each other while trying to ignore calls from Ben's wife, who's desperate to see if he's alive.
You know why I can't
answer? Yeah, I know. Why.
We've discussed it.
I know.
Why I'm not answering the phone. Or, I mean, come on.
The meal ticket. I know.
So, all right then. Doesn't mean I'm not torn up about this. That it doesn't, you know, cover my soul.
Cover my soul? Jesus, Ben,
it please. It moves me. Of course it does. But we've got to look at the implications here. What it means to us. Our future.
Just before curtain call, Neil LaBute talked about his relationship to the lovers.
Ben and Abby are sort of extensions of, not my paranoia, but my imagination. I remember this play kind of came out of an interest in what else was happening at the time. There was such a national surge of patriotism and nationalism around the time of 9/11. And my writerly instinct said, well, there must be other stories out there. There must be something other than everyone behaving well and heroically and admirably toward one another. There must be some other beat that's going on out there. And even if it wasn't, as long as the idea that I had was possible, that's all a writer ever needs, is to be living in the realm of possibility. I'm often interested in relationships and how they work and how they don't work. So to me, it was more fascinating to look at two people who certainly felt the repercussions of that day, but were in the middle of a relationship that had to be dealt with, rather than everything stopping and them dealing with 9/11. 9/11 just became another aspect of their relationship.
When this premiered, it premiered in New York City. You directed it. And now here we are at the Lyric Stage, and it's being put on, you know, director you don't know, actors you don't know. How does it feel right now to just be sitting here right before the production starts?
Well, it feels great. It's all about possibilities beforehand. And I have no idea. That's the exciting thing about theater, is that, you know, you go to a film, other than the electricity going out, there's nothing that's going to change the experience if I watch it in Boston or I watch it in New York or I watch it in my house. It's a piece of art that's already been created. Here, this is a fresh interpretation of something that I wrote a few years ago now. It's already interesting to see how close we are to the actors and to see the way in which they've decided to stage the play. So those kinds of things excite me.
Well, it looks like it's getting ready to start, so we'll talk a little more afterwards.
Okay, great.
Save it.
Hmm?
The phone. I turned it off to save it.
That's okay.
I know it's okay. I know that. That's why I did it, because it's okay.
Right.
If you're not going to use it, then you should keep it off. Save the battery.
Sure.
Plus the sound drives me crazy, you know?
Sorry, I didn't hear it.
Oh. Okay.
The bickering escalates into a power struggle that's been compared to George and Martha's battle in Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And the ending is signature LaBute, with one last twist of the screw leaving the lovers and the audience wondering. So I'm certainly not going to ask you to critique the play. I don't think that's really the purpose here of you being here, but Do you ever wish you could make a change as you're listening to the lines?
Oh, I always think that. I always think that, you know, if I had another crack at it, I would change this or that. Or I hear a line and go, maybe I could change that or add something. But that's the nice thing about theater as well. Every so often you do get the chance to add something or take it away. That's what I think is exciting about it, is every night you don't know if they're going to make a mistake or not or how an audience will react to it.
The play itself is organic in that respect. You kind of let it go once you've written it and it goes off into another director's hands and different actors' hands. What's that like?
Well, I guess that's what it's meant to be. It's a blueprint, sort of, that it's not scripture. Some playwrights always look at their work and don't want you to change a comma or you know, take anything out. I'm really a believer in making it work for a given production. So I'm more drawn to people taking something and making it their own. And it's easy for me to give it up and hand it over. And I also have somebody to blame that way. If things go badly, then I can just point a finger, which I'm happy to do.
So would you mind if, say, a director or somebody changed something like Ben and Abby's sexual orientation, if it was two guys or something? I mean, how much would you object to?
As long as it's valid, if they can make a case for it. I find that a hard case to make, actually. But I think that it's always interesting when people take Shakespeare and want to do various adaptations or readings of it. We see it less often in realistic plays, you know, or plays of this century.
Your first time you studied drama was in college at Brigham Young University.
Yeah, I first kind of formal training was in college at Brigham Young. Yes, I went to Brigham Young on a scholarship. I wasn't a Mormon at the time. I got a scholarship there as a non-Mormon, but joined the church while I was there.
And while you were there, your plays garnered a lot of attention, positive and negative. But you kept writing these plays. Why?
To me, it's not about attention. You know, there's much easier ways to get attention. You could run out in the square and strip down and run around. You get plenty of attention at Brigham Young. You know, I don't mind provoking an audience, but it's certainly not my chore. It's not what I'm destined to do, to make them sit up and take notice. Whether it's negative or positive attention, I'm happy when an audience is awake. It would take more than a review or an administrator at a school to say, stop doing that, to make me not want to write.
So how did you deal with it?
Well, like any student, you know, you say yes to their face and turn around and do what you want. I mean, that's the way students, you know, are made. They are there to question authority and to ask why. And I was just someone who asked why a lot. If I couldn't do a play in a kind of legitimate theater space, I would create my own space.
So what do you tell young playwrights? I mean, you taught at NYU in the fall, and what do you tell them about theater today and how they can get to where they might want to be?
I tell them to get a law degree and to always have a backup plan. You know, I had a backup plan. I went to school for a number of years so that I could teach. The beauty of writing is that you can write wherever you are. If you're a cook or if you're in prison or if you're a doctor, you can always sit down and write. And so it doesn't hurt to have some other ability to generate an income, because it is a hard road. You know, ironically, now I make more money with my playwriting after I've done films. You know, before that, it was hard to get people to read my plays. Who knows what would have happened if I just continued to try and write for the theater?
Well, wondering what would have happened is moot, because Neil LaBute is carving out plenty of work for himself as a dramatic writer.
I've got another film that I'm trying to get made at the moment, and I do have a play that's going on in New York. I've been writing short stories, and I have a book of short stories that'll be published in the fall. And I've written the pilot for a television series for Showtime. So I've been kind of dabbling in other mediums, as well as continuing the film and theater work, because I'm just a writer. I tend to like to write, and so on any given day, if you were to stumble onto me in a, you know, street corner or at home, I tend to have a pencil in my hand and or muttering to myself about some new piece of work.
Author and playwright Neil LaBute speaking with Here and Now producer Andrea Shea. For more information on the play, The Mercy Seat, visit our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories.